I hate to say answer questions, you know, we ain't kind of work those things. Yeah, we're just, and Bob Dylan said, you know, ain't no sense talking to me, it's just like talking to you, you know what I mean? Martin, the Human Rights Party candidate for Third Ward in the Ann Arbor City Council elections is here. And Righteous Robert Rudnick, who is a famous radio personality known across the nation, who is presently on CJOM FM in Windsor Sunday night from 6 to 10. No commercials, I mean, you know, isn't trying to sell nothing except Rudnick.
Thank you, bro.
Yeah.
I'd like to ask you, you know, Rolling Stone just did a weird article on you and, the Lennons. How would you like to reply about that? You know, how they sort of made, especially the last line where they talked about where Sinclair said, I mean, where Lennon's supposed to have said, well, he was just a manager of a band, and then he took acid and he got political.
Yeah. No, we're going to have a problem. We're going to get some kind of supersonic scanner, you know. It's hard to talk loud anyway. That was a weird article, but on the other hand, I was really encouraged by the fact that they put it in, because Rolling Stone has historically, and particularly in the last, you know, a couple of years, done everything they could to undermine the idea of any kind of alliance between people in the music industry, you know, workers in the music industry, i.e. bands, and people on the streets. You know, Rolling Stone's essential function, you see, has been from the beginning and increasingly to take the music and turn it into a super commodity, and then to peddle it, you know, and influence taste and stuff like that, and to douse the whole idea that it should be any different. You know, in other words, generally they want to project the image of rock and roll stars getting rich and buying $18,000 Aston Martins and villas on the French Riviera and stuff like that, you see. Whereas for the same period of time, we've been advancing the position that rock and roll bands particularly must take the money that they make from playing the music that people give them and bring it back to the communities of the people who support them and make them what they are, you know. So, in other words, it's been over a period of time, going back at least to 1968, the Rolling Stone has attempted to completely squelch, you know, these ideas, and you know. So I was like, I liked the article for the reason that it was some kind of, as positive as Rolling Stone could be given that history, a positive expression of the possibility of this kind of thing happening with John Lennon and Yoko Ono, you know.
So see,
I've
been trying for 2 years to get Jan Wenner, the editor, to write something about John that would help get him out. You know, we were trying hard to make John's case into a national case so it would get more attention and help sustain the fight. And he always refused. He refused to put in an ad, you know. So all of a sudden, you know, he has to come around and print something about us that is not totally negative, and it's a step forward for that reason.
Yeah, but what about the way they sort of attack Lennon and Yoko, you know?
Oh, that's what they're doing. I mean, that's what everybody, you know. I mean, they step forward, you see. As far as I'm concerned, they step forward, and they made a tremendous breakthrough in the whole rock and roll industry, you know, by stepping forward and saying, we're going to sing songs about Attica State, you know, we're going to participate in movements to get political prisoners released. You know, we're going to participate in this whole range of activity that has been forbidden, right, in the past to people of our stature. And so as soon as they do this, there's all these vultures, you know, who are sitting around who have an entirely cynical attitude, which is produced by the fact that they spend all their time working for big imperialist corporations like Columbia Records and RCA Victor and Capitol and Rolling Stone, which is owned by Kenny Parking Lots, you know, and the various other record companies. I mean, they spend all their time, they make their living writing propaganda for the bullshit garbage that's put out by these companies for the most part. So they have a cynical, you see, they have a cynical outlook, you know. And anytime any kind of positive thing starts to emerge, they just pour on a bucket of cynicism, you know, and try and douse it out. And this is essentially what's happening with that. So they're going to try and ridicule, you know, this whole attempt. They're going to talk about the bed, right, and all that stuff. But I mean, essentially what counts, you see, is people who are out in the streets, you know, people who are out listening to the music and following what's going on and checking everything out. That's essentially what's going to count, you see. In other words, in the final analysis, something like Rolling Stone or Columbia Records or those things, they aren't the things that are powerful, you know. They aren't the things that are going to decide what happens, you know, who decides is us, essentially, you see. And essentially what will happen is that if John Lennon and Yoko Ono don't get scared off by all this bullshit, you know, and all these vultures, that they'll continue with the program and involve themselves more and more. And in 6 months or 8 months or a year, you see, Rolling Stone will then be writing articles saying how wonderful socialism is, you see. because that will be the thing. I mean, essentially they want to, you know, manipulate and exploit their readers, you know. So, I mean, I didn't mean to go into a, you know, such a hell of a rap, but it's important to understand what a magazine like that means and what a piece like that, you know, means. It, for example, like Lenny said, we made consistent efforts over 2.5 years to get them to help us, you know, get me out of the penitentiary, right? They refused, you know. During this period, I was commissioned at one point to write an hour. I wrote a 35-page manifesto on what should be going on in the rock and roll industry in terms of self-determination and in terms of non-greed-oriented ventures, right, by bands and shit. And they refused to print it when it was submitted. You see, all of that goes on. And they would like to write an article saying this is all bullshit, you know, and people shouldn't pay any attention to it and this is all wrong. They can't do that, you see, because people know better, you know. So I look on something like that, which on the surface looks really bold, you know. When you go into it deeper, it shows that pressure has been exerted to make them change their position, you know. And they're only important because like 300,000 people, you know, like us, go down to the stands and pick up a copy and read it, you know. If nobody read them, they wouldn't be important. They're important because people read them, and it's our people, it's people we're concerned with, you know. Yeah.
A couple years ago, when you were in prison, I went to the, we were playing sports in the inner courtyard, and I remember seeing you there. And as a prisoner there, now I know some people that have worked there. I'm from the Pelham Market prisoner.
Oh, Marquette.
Whether, I remember a couple years ago, they said how bad the conditions are, and then talk to some of their guards, and they'll say that it's the prisoners for all the prisoners.
Yeah.
What your personal
opinion
is, how they run it.
At Marquette?
Yes.
Oh.
How long were you there?
Was you in, what, hockey teams or football teams that used to come in? Hockey? All right. That's a good, you know. That's about the best thing that they had up there, you know. Having people from the outside come in there. But essentially, Marquette is like the Attica of Michigan. You know? No, I mean, I'm completely serious when I say that. Like Attica, Marquette is way up, hundreds of miles away from the place where most of the inmates are from. You know, i.e. it's 500 miles from Detroit. So the majority of inmates being poor, I mean, the overwhelming, you know, 98% of inmates being poor, this precludes their people from visiting them, see? This cuts off their communication. Marquette is used as the super maximum security joint of Michigan, where people who have or who begin to develop any kind of political consciousness, while they're in Jackson or Ionia, the camp program, or any of those other places,
and begin to start to educate themselves politically and to organize other prisoners, they're sent to Marquette, you see. Inmates who present any kind of problem of any kind are sent up there, you know, and where they can effectively be isolated unless they have any money, you know,
also,
unless they have somebody behind them.
Also prisoners who escape from other institutions.
Yeah, prisoners who escape, right, that's a good point. Prisoners who escape from other institutions are also sent there. It's about 600 inmates inside the walls. It's small. It's like a 100-year-old institution. They're just getting, when I was run out of there in September of 1970, they were just getting hot water in the last three cell blocks. You know, when I was there, the year I did there, they'd come around in the morning and before breakfast and in the afternoon after work and once again in the evening with a bucket of hot, you know, hot water, and you have a little can like this that they fill up. You can wash your face and hands and shave and stuff like that. I mean, that's the kind of, you know, the cells are like as long as a bed and about this wide. You know, they're just little, I mean, it's just an old joint, you know. Zero. They, well, see, here's what the deal is, man. Essentially, they feel that the people who are sent, who they send there, are not rehabilitatable, you know. Therefore, they have no rehabilitation program. I mean, I imagine that's their operating premise. It used to be, before the last, say, 7 to 10 years, when, you know, since the inmate consciousness began to rise, and particularly since 65 and 67, when the political consciousness of people in the black ghettos began to rise to a point where you had people coming to the penitentiary for crimes who weren't just pimps, you know, who were sticking up banks because of, you know, the political role of banks in the economy and shit like that, see. So before that point, Marquette was where they sent lifers. You know, and guys with 20 to 40 and 50 to 70 and stuff like that. And they would go up there and do 10 years up there before then they would start considering that they could put them somewhere else, you see. So that's what it was. And so it still retains kind of a mixed character, right? Because there's still all them old guys who are mostly white or older black prisoners who, you know, who are doing life or who are doing them enormous inhuman sentences, you see, who keep to themselves and don't cause no trouble because they live there, you see. They live there for the rest of their life, so they're very quiet. There used to be a lot of privileges there. They used to let them order pizza from downtown on Friday nights, and, and all the older dudes say they really liked it, you know. But also in those days, until 1965, they didn't have, there were two blocks that didn't have running water at all where you shit in a can, you know. Until 1965, that existed there, you see. So it was just an old-fashioned penitentiary, you know, for people doing long bits. And then when they started to get trouble, then they started sending them there because it was just the perfect place.
Siberia.
Yeah, it was Siberia, you know. And you could send people there, you can cut off their communication. I mean, you can hold people incommunicado if you want to. That isn't the general nature of the prison system, isn't to hold people incommunicado, you know. One of the few things that's almost guaranteed is that you can write letters at least to your attorneys and the courts and stuff like that, you know. So that isn't a general standard, you know, to hold people in, just particular individuals are held incommunicado at times. At Marquette, they can just cut you off, you see. I mean, at Marquette, they could kill you and nobody would know about it, you know, until they start checking into it. If you were an average, you know, like if you were from a poor black person from Detroit who was sent up there with people can't go up there to visit and maybe can't read or write, you know, so the communication is very limited. I mean, they might go a year, you know, before they would know something happened to their son unless somebody took a particular, you see what I mean? That's the kind of thing that it is, you know.
They used to weld prisoners in the
Yeah, cell. They used to weld prisoners in the hole. You know, like they, and that went on until like 65, I believe. They used to take prisoners that were problems. And of course, in a situation like that, if a prisoner was a problem, he was a problem. You know, because they were all there for life, you know, for, you know, a long period of years. And if somebody was causing trouble or something like that, and he presented a problem in that area, and they would isolate that person, you know? And they would isolate him by putting him in the hole and then welding the door shut for a year. Whoa. One guy was in there for 6 years. You dig?
No, they're building new cells up there that are completely isolated from each other, and each cell has their own shower, so they don't even have to go to mix showers with other
prisoners. This is the new Michigan super maximum security joint for political prisoners and agitators. It's a Marquette being built just outside the wall and connected to the administration area by an underground tunnel, and where prisoners who cause any problem up there try to organize, that is, I'll get to that in a minute, what they consider problems, but prisoners who create some kind of problem for them can be given the system, the usual Marquette treatment, which is to beat them into submission and gas them and handcuff them and throw them into a laundry basket and wheel them down to the hole. They can now be wheeled all the way outside of prison, so there's no way they could have any contact with any other prisoners, so no one would know what was going on with them, you see. And they can be put in this special isolation unit where the cells are being built separated from each other, you see. In other words, usually a cell block has a row of cells, you know, it just walls in between. These are individual compartments. We understand that each will have its own shower, and each will have its own little ventilator in the top so gas can be sprayed in individually. Because one of the main complaints that they had to deal with from the Human Rights Commission and shit is that prisoners always complain of being tear gassed when they're just sitting in their cells, because the police, the goon squad will come in and tear gas one inmate in one cell, but the tear gas will get all over the block, you see. They want to solve that problem, so they're having individual gas vents.
There's an auditorium over in this building with microphones.
Oh, no.
I don't think people would.
Yeah.
Is this all right?
Yeah.
Okay. What I was going to say about trouble, this is where I got into trouble. One of the greatest honors in my life, actually, was getting run out of Marquette Prison, you know? That was a great compliment, you know. Well, what? What I was generally interested in was breaking down the isolation of Marquette Prison from, particularly, the black inmates in Marquette Prison from the outside world, you know. And I was constructing like a long-range plot, you know, to bring this about, which involved establishing ties with the black Air Force captives, essentially, at Kitchelo Air Force Base up there, and the black students at Northern Michigan University, and also with white liberal professors at Northern Michigan University, you see. And particularly to establish situations so the inmates in the penitentiary would have close links with black people, the few black people that there were up there in that community. So if something happened, in other words, to set up a thing where maybe black students at the university could set up visiting relations with certain inmates, you see, and visit them regularly, you know, so that there would always be a link. If something went on, something went down inside, there would always be a way to get that word out. You know what I mean? That was the first thing that I was interested in. And then, as a function of this, and it wasn't myself, I was working with a number of brothers in the penitentiary. And we were talking and trying to figure out ways, and this is the way that we came up with, you know? And another way that we figured to move was to mount a struggle to obtain a black studies program, starting with a black history course in the prison academic school, see? And because this was it was a thing that they needed, you know, that the inmates there needed was a program like this. They try to keep it at 50%, they keep a racial balance sheet, they try and keep it at 50%, but since, due to the racist nature of the, you know, capitalism, et cetera, et cetera, we find that black people are being impressed into the penitentiaries at a rate far exceeding that which white inmates are being inducted into that situation. So that, for example, in the prison system overall in Michigan, I believe the ratio is 70% black now, you see. So it was, they tried to hold a 50-50 thing because one of the main weapons of the prison administrations is racism, you know. And they try to maintain situations where there is, quote, racial tension, you know, because that takes the focus off of them and makes the inmates think that other inmates are their main problem, you see. Whereas, in fact, it's the prison administration which is their main problem, you see. So they try to hold this 50-50 thing to maintain an even tension, you see. But it's creeping up all the time, you know. And again, most of the white inmates that are up there aren't prisoners with any kind of political consciousness or troublemakers or anything. Mostly they're guys doing long bits who don't have any families, who like it up there because they still have more privileges than in Jackson because it's smaller, right? So most of the white inmates are that type or inmates who have escaped and have been sent there as security risks, you see. Whereas most of the black inmates, they are inmates who have been sent there for some kind of political reason, you know. Either they were troublemakers of some kind or organizers or something in Jackson or Ionia or someplace else. So that's the difference, you know, in the black population, the white population in Marquette, you know. The white prisoners are mostly the old brand of prisoners, while the black inmates are characteristically the new brand of prisoners, you know. That's why we were concentrating on that particular area, because, the white prisoners are just deep into the do-your-own-time rules, you see, and don't bother me with no shit, I'll just do my time, and I'm not concerned about somebody else's problems, see. So the potential for organizing among those prisoners is very low, you know. It's hard to overcome that. It's hard to explain to them, for example, why it's in their interest to go to the hole for a year, you see, which is just what you have to, I mean, if you start moving, you have to anticipate that if you got some time, you're minimally going to be locked up for a year. You're going to, if you have a chance of parole, you're going to blow your chance at parole, you see. All of that, I mean, it's really substantial risk, you know. Yes. Well, essentially, being locked up for that period of time under the conditions I was locked up didn't really change my thinking about anything, but rather sharpened it up. You know what I mean? Ho Chi Minh had a beautiful prison poem that he wrote that says, "Calamity has hardened and tempered me and turned my mind into steel," you know. And essentially that's the way I was able to, and I'm not trying to speak from any kind of self-glorification thing, but this is a matter of fact, you know, that I was able to, like, clone my mind, you know, and concentrate it on problems and able to sit and read for days and ends, see, because I wasn't, you know, I was locked up, you know. So, I mean, a prison affords an opportunity like this. It can take a man like George Jackson, who was a 17-year-old diddy bob sticking up gas stations and shit, into a mastermind, international revolutionary genius, you see, without ever having the benefit of talking to any other people, you know, or being in the hole for 7 years, man. You know, 7 years, every day, day after day, you know, just in there with a book and a bed and a, you know, maybe a desk and a chair, you see. No, I got my friend here made sure that I had all the books that they would let me get in. At Marquette, I had no problem. In Jackson, political literature is banned because it's a much larger institution and they're terrified to death.
No red, you know, books.
Like red books, for example, are strictly forbidden, you know. Terrified. They see a red book, they turn and jump under the bed or something, you know. They're terrified because the potential is so, the objective situation is so severe, you know what I mean? The people are beginning to just look around, you know, just say, "I'm really oppressed." You know, this ain't it.
Yeah.
Is that for the water by the lantern?
Yeah.
No, it's just one. Are the guards?
Are the guards intelligent?
Well, they're not politically. I mean, do they react against you with, do they differentiate you political person or anything?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, how do they react?
Well, their initial reaction was what the newspapers and the television told them to be, you know. They wanted to kill me, in other words, you know. But time after time, I undertook to rigorously discipline myself, you know. I mean, I considered every moment that my life was in jeopardy, you know what I mean? And I felt that they were engaged in a continual hunt for an excuse to shoot me, essentially. That's the way I felt, you know. And again, that's the way George Jackson felt, and that's finally what happened to him, you see. So it isn't paranoia, you know, it's righteous fear, right? So out of that righteous fear, I disciplined myself very carefully, and out of my general gregariousness also, you see, and just liking people and liking to get along with people, I would try to treat them as humanly as possible, the guards, you know what I mean, and try and be as nice and not be reactionary and not be bitter and, you know, rebellious and all of that shit, see. So, to say that my repeated experience with guards was that after I'd be in a particular block or a particular situation around a particular guard or guards, after a couple of weeks they would come by my cell and rap, you know, and they would say, I thought you were just what I read in the papers, right? And, Jesus Christ, you're a pretty nice guy, you know. And then we'd talk, you know, and we, you know, and then they would want to talk because I was in, it was in the papers and stuff all the time. I was a celebrity, you know, so they could go home to their wife and kids and say, I talked to John Sinclair today. He's in my block, you know. And you know what I mean? So I always tried to accommodate that, you know, because it could mean the difference between getting shot the next day and not, essentially, to me. That's what it meant to me, you know. That was where all my trouble was with, was the administration, you see. The guards, I mean, as Attica showed, right? The guards are the prisoners also, you see. When the guards have no power, they're workers, you know.
Almost
They're, go ahead.
They're poor people, too. They get a job as a guard in the penitentiary because they can't find a job anywhere else. A lot of...
Yeah, they're essentially, like at Jackson, they're essentially farmers, you know, who, yeah. I mean, they essentially are people who come off farms around in Jackson County, you know, and who have, like in Marquette, the job of guard at the prison is the best job in the UP. I'm serious. You see, the UP is an economically depressed area with, you know, zero industry, et cetera, et cetera. So the prison, when you get on civil service, you get a job at the prison, and you got a job for the rest of your life. There's generations that work there, you see. That came up also in Attica, you know, the same kind of situation. Small town, and it's actually the best job in the UP for a working person, you know. Of course. Of course. But, you see, what it speaks to is not the problem of them being guards, but the problem of racism. You see? The problem of just general honky, you know, brutality. You see? But not, I mean, as far as their position of having any power is concerned, they have no, I mean, Nelson Rockefeller can go in and shoot 10 guards and 32 inmates. You know, he doesn't care. They have no power, you see. I mean, essentially, the wardens in them have no power, you know. I mean, they have a standing rule in penitentiaries where if a break or a riot or something goes down and the warden is snatched off and somebody tries to use him to get out the front door, they shoot the warden, you see. That's what happened, for example, that policy is what led to the death of Jonathan Jackson and William Christmas
and William McLean, I mean James Fitzwilliam McLean, and Judge Haley in the San Rafael courthouse thing on August 7, 1970, where this whole elaborate plan was set up, and the jurors and the judge were taken off, and they were all in the car, and all the police there had the sense, you know, to know that if they started shooting, that the judge and those jurors' lives were in danger. Everybody held their fire except the prison guard who was there to escort the prisoners, and the prison guard opened fire with his .30-30 and shot the driver, and that's when the judge was shot, you see. So, I mean, that's the kind of power. They don't have any sense. They're just taught to shoot. There's something weird going on, shoot, you know. No, I mean, seriously, you know, that's a very serious policy.
Is
you
that
know?
For the
yeah.
No.
Yeah, can you tell me a little bit about the Rainbow Party, you know? Rainbow People's Party, right.
Yeah, what would you like to know?
I mean, you know, I don't know anything about it. Can you run it down to me a little bit?
The way you're talking about the guards, it sounds like that prison thing was like a supplemental income. You know, like
No, not. I mean, they're farmers. They would have been farmers, is what I meant to say. You see what I mean? Oh, no. But some of them, a lot of them moonlight. A lot of them have a little bit, like especially in Marquette, like the guard who run the tailor shop also had some kind of laundry or dry cleaners or something like that downtown, you see. The guy who would come in and teach in the vocational school, welding and stuff like that, might have a welding shop downtown, you see. But I mean, at Jackson, I'm saying that these are people who would, in an earlier time, would have been farm, would have stayed on the farm, you know, but with the farms being mechanized and...
None of them have a really high education.
Oh, no. No, they're just honkies, you know. Essentially. You know, and they're, I mean, and I'm not trying to, I'm just trying to get at the essential point, which is, you know, that the struggle isn't against the guards, you know what I mean? Politically, the struggle is not against the guards at all. You know, the guards have no political power, you see. And once that point is made, then what I wanted to say about the guards was that individually, there are many brutal, vicious dogs, right, who are guards. The overwhelming 99% majority of the white guards are stone racists, you know, et cetera, you see. But on the other hand, the day-to-day operation of a penitentiary, you have a block with 500 men in it, living in this block, locked in cells and out and around. This block is run by two officers. Yeah. See, so that's, I mean, there isn't a day-to-day thing going on like this all over the penitentiary, you see. Once in a while, something erupts, you know. You see what I mean? I'm just concerned to give an accurate picture of... Yeah. No, I'm sorry to give that impression.
Can you go back to that book?
Yeah, I want to get back to that. Do you want to, maybe Jeannie could talk about the party.
Number one, you were before the White Panther Party, right?
Right.
Is that like more or less like a reaction where they had the Black Panther Party to serve the black community and to help the black community get its thing together, that you more or less helping the white people get it, the white community get
white
its thing
youth.
Together. Right, the white youth. Now,
there is,
the White
see,
Panther
we...
Party now. Let me get my point first. It's the Rainbow People Party now. Is it for both like black people, white people, and yellow people? Like, is it operating on the same thing and just getting white youth together? So someday, you know, we can live all together and all this beautiful socialism stuff. Or are you operating on the same basis? Like, is there like black people in the Rainbow People's Party, or is it still essentially more or less the same principles of the White Panther Party?
Yeah, I got here, you know, I saw
the morning. I didn't hear what the dude said.
I'll try and repeat some of it. It's all to the point of your question. What's going on?
He thinks that this brother cut him off. He was just trying to make your question clear that we could have a start at it. You know, that's all he was trying to do.
Okay. Yeah, it wasn't weird at all.
We're just blasted.
Well, then we should deal with this historically. The White Panther Party has a history, you know, a prehistory to it, you know, which goes back to 1964, the Artists' Workshop in Detroit, Translove Energies. We were in Detroit for 4 years. We moved to Ann Arbor in the spring of 1968 and settled there as Translove Energies. We managed a rock and roll band called the MC5. Another band called The Up, and we worked with a third band called The Stooges from Ann Arbor. And we were engaged in cultural agitation and craziness, essentially. And during the summer of 1968, while carrying out our program of rock and roll, dope, and fucking in the streets, with the MC5, we were subjected increasingly to attacks and harassment by police, city officials, and other
creeps like that, you know.
So, for example, we'd be booked into a place with a band just for a rock and roll dance, you know. And there would be some move on the part of the city council in that particular town or village or city or whatever it would be, to tell the club owner that if he let the MC5 play in his joint, they would take his license away, you know, and stuff like that. We had incidents where we were beaten up by police on the job, you know, for saying, kick out the jams, motherfucker, you know. And just increasingly, all this weird stuff came down, you know, and culminating in a certain extent, our people were getting popped, for things like dispensing one roach, you know, which is a 20-year minimum sentence, and held on $20,000 bonds in Traverse City, Pomponda, in the summer of 1968, at the same time all this other shit was going down, you know. And then the thing in Chicago went down around the Democratic Convention, and there was supposed to be this festival of life where bands from all the country were going to come and blah, blah, blah. And when it came down to August 25th, the MC5 was the only band that showed up in the whole country, you know, to play. And then while we were playing, the police started moving in the park and, you know, kicking ass. So that, and Eldridge Cleaver became a very strong influence on us through his writings. And then he came to Ann Arbor to be nominated for president on the Peace and Freedom Party ticket right at the same time, in August, I believe it was. And we heard him speak, and we were reading the Black Panther newspaper and following the writings of Huey P. Newton, and became deeply influenced by that. You know, and all these things culminated when Pun got out of the Traverse County Jail in September. We started talking about taking on a more overtly political stance, you know. In other words, we were really pissed off, you know. And we had come from a position where we thought that you could just carry on like maniacs, you know, and get high and carry on and drop out and, you know, start communes and just doing everything different than the way it was supposed to be. And we thought you could just do that and get away with it, you know. If they wouldn't, they'd be glad to get rid of us, you see. And that's where we started out from. We came increasingly to find that they weren't going to let us do that, you know, that we began to learn that they had a real vested interest in us, i.e., you know, like, there was just, you know, there was just like a small thing of people who were doing this stuff at that time. And they were sitting back in their offices and shit, and pictures like this, you see, were sprouting up in their mind, you know, and visions of things like free clinics and free hospitals and
vast anti-war movements and stuff like that were all springing up in their minds, and they said, this isn't, we aren't going to let this happen, you know, and so they would start actively trying to suppress it before it could get out of hand, right? And we were the victims, you know, we were the immediate victims of this suppression attack because we were the ones who were trying to do all this shit. So it came down to the point in the fall of 1968, and Pun got out of Travis County Jail, and he started talking about what he went through in there and various readings that he had done, Frantz Fanon and Huey P. Newton and Eldridge Cleaver, and he had read a whole lot of other stuff, Fidel Castro and Che Guevara and all that while he was in the Travis County Jail. And he was really swept, you know, and he's particularly swept by Huey P. Newton and Eldridge Cleaver, you know, and so was I. And I was relating to him essentially what our experiences had been while he was in jail all that summer when all this shit had went down. And we were saying, and Bobby Seale, we read speeches by Bobby Seale and also by Huey P. Newton where they had caught an interview with Huey P. Newton in a magazine called The Movement where he had called for, he had said black people have to organize black people in their community, and these young white mother country radicals are interested in supporting this struggle, then their job is to organize people in their communities, you know, and that there should be white panther parties and stuff like this, you see. And we said, right on, you know, this is absolutely right, you know. So we embraced these ideas and formed spontaneously without any charter or any contact or anything except what we read in their paper and read the book with the Black Panther Party. You know, we just said, okay, we're going to be the White Panther Party, you know, and we're going to take all this stuff that we've been talking about for years through the music and through the poetry and through all the stuff we've been doing and codify it into a program, you know. And the program will start with total support and endorsement of the Black Panther Party's 10-point program and platform. It would be point number one. And then point number two is that we are involved in a total assault on the culture by any means necessary, including rock and roll, dope, and fucking in the streets, right? And then after that, it would go on to say that we want, you know, free food and free housing and free medical care, and we want a free, you know, all time and space, and dissolve all unnatural boundaries. We want all prisoners free from prison. We want the end of military conscription, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And essentially, we want everything free for everybody. We want a free planet, you know. So we codified this into a so-called political program, wrote it down on paper, and we invented a button that was purple with a white panther on it. And we wrote up some propaganda and all of that, you know, and just put it out. It was all just a thing that was on paper, you know, it was just a myth. And anybody, essentially, the White Panther Party was, anybody who wanted to put on one of those buttons was a member of the White Panther Party, you know. And if you were in Lansing or Toledo or Dubuque, Iowa or someplace like that, and there were three or four of you that had White Panther buttons, you know, and like the MC5 and stuff like that, that you could be a chapter of the White Panther Party, you see. And that was essentially what the White Panther Party was about, you know. And then we went through a whole phase of reacting in a very extreme fashion to the kind of attacks that were coming down not on us, but also on, you know, black people, on people involved in political activity of any kind, becoming increasingly aware of the continuing horror and you know, in Indochina and all, you know, and I mean, just realizing that day after day after day they're pounding Laos and Cambodia and shit, you know, should really set you back, man, you know. I mean, they've taken Laos and made a motherfucking crater out of it, man, you know. I mean, they're doing this, they, you know, and you just get so goddamn mad, you know, and then you just start hollering and screaming as if that's going to stop it, you see. So we got into all just being just super pissed off, man, you know. How can they do this shit, you know? Kill them, you know. Off the pigs,
That's a pig, see?
Which is really a righteous response, you know. You know what I mean? But in the end... No, I'm cool. When I used that time, man, it kept me locked up, you know, so... didn't get to talk to nobody, so when I get started talking, I just talk, you know. Get all this shit wound up. You know, you just sit and think about this shit, man, day after day, you know. I wish I could talk to somebody, you know.
So,
anyway, go ahead.
Yeah.
Bring me up to date.
Maybe this will bring you up to date. So what the White Panther Party was, you know, like you said, just anybody who wanted to put on a
yeah.
Stay off the pig.
Right. And well, not only that, but also... Yeah, not just off the pig, but also that, we wanted to create a new social order on this planet where everything will be free for everybody and racism and imperialism and all that will be eliminated, you know.
The media just projected on
and,
the rainbow party. No,
what's
rainbow?
What's the rainbow party now?
Ah. Anyway, this is... I think the best way to proceed is historically, you know, and we can get up to this. So this is like the spring of 1969, going into the summer of 1969. And then I got locked up in July of 1969 on this 9.5 to 10 year sentence. And this only increased, you know, the level of militancy of the people who were behind, and they got farther out, and then so the federal government then brought indictments on myself, Pompliano, and Jack Forrest for conspiracy to blow up the CIA, you know, and Pun went underground, you know, he was put on the FBI's 10 most wanted list, et cetera, et cetera. And we continued to direct all of our activity at the government and at, you know, through the papers and mostly, and also what we didn't do there was caught up in defense efforts and shit like that, you know. So we were essentially put in the position of the average radical group which has no ties with the people on the streets and which carries on its activity in the newspapers and aimed at other radicals around the country, showing, see who can be more revolutionary than anybody else and all that, you see. And we were caught up in this situation for some time until Pond, Jack Forrest, and Skip Tawby got captured in July of 1970 in the Upper Peninsula on the way to some place where Pond was going to be hiding out, essentially. And they were captured in this weirdo situation and ended up, Pond's been in locked up ever since then, and Jack and Skip also were convicted of aiding and abetting a federal fugitive and received 5-year sentences in federal penitentiaries. So there was like 4 of us in the penitentiaries, you know. And the people on the street, I mean, and it was just a matter of finally having to come to a realization that this was entirely the wrong way to go about solving the problem, that if we kept attacking the problem this way, we'd all be in the penitentiary, you know. And that when you sit down and think about it, being in the penitentiary doesn't do anybody any good at all, you know. So therefore, essentially, we were engaged in an incorrect method of work, you know. If you wanted to really deal with the problems that people have and try and bring about a change, and you're in the penitentiary, and all of you are in the there isn't anything you can do to help the people, you know. So then we went through a period of 8 or 9 months of internal discussion, and by this time we had developed a cadre of people who had been living and working together for 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years, which was relatively stable, which could support itself economically, and which was engaged primarily in trying to get us out of the penitentiary and keep us from getting more time. So there was beginning to be more than just something on paper, beginning to be some kind of little structure, you know,
that had some stability, you know, in a particular area with roots in that community, you know. So this collectivity began discussion. Four of us were in the penitentiary. I had been engaged in a year of intensive study, political study and thought, systematic study and thought. And we began, and as the other three brothers were locked up, they also began a process of study and thought, which, you know, is dictated by the penitentiary and the jail system, where that's all you can do. So you really can get deep into it, you know. So over the course of this, like, 9-month period, we went through a whole lot of discussion, argument, struggle. Some people left, you know. Other people were asked to leave. Our positions changed from week to week. New ideas were thrown forth. We tried to undertake a more or less systematic analysis of the situation in the world and in this country and in our community, et cetera, you know. And what we began to develop was an understanding, one, and this might seem like a big jump, but we'll start another circle and maybe come back around to this. You know, we started to understand, one, that there was no such thing, for example, as a white community, you know. That you could talk about a black community, but you couldn't talk about a white community, because there were essentially two clearly definable communities within what they call the white America, you know. There was all these people who related to Vaughn Monroe and Lawrence Welk and the Detroit Lions and, you know, and the whole honky trip, you know, and which extends to Leonard Bernstein, you know, and, I mean, it goes in all directions, you know. Essentially, European, people related to European culture, you know, and to America and neon and all that, see. And on the other hand, there are these people who are also white complected or pink complected, whatever you want to say, who were into a whole different thing, you know. And that these were people who started out, being a few of them, you know, and very rapidly began to increase, a whole new phenomenon, you know, like people like us haven't ever existed on this planet before, because these particular conditions, material conditions, there has never been television before, or radio, you see, you know, all of the conditions that obtain now, we began to realize that this has produced a whole new people, essentially, you know, that you couldn't, you know, if you start thinking about white people, you know, and I got to the point over a period of years where I didn't ever want to be identified as a white person anyway, because white people to me meant Lyndon Johnson, you know, and John M. Mitchell and Spiro P. Agnew and Richard P. Nixon and people like that, you know. And I didn't ever want to be associated with people like that. You know, the people I looked up to were people like Malcolm X and John Coltrane, you know, and Jimi Hendrix, and, you know, who were essentially black people, you know, and the people I began increasingly to look up to were not, you know, I mean, I began to personally, you know, to think that the best thing that could happen to the world would be the destruction of Western civilization, you know, even if it meant me, you see. I didn't really relate to it, but if they wanted to call me part of that, then I'd be glad to go in order to get rid of it, because it was so awful, you know, that it was oppressing people all over the world. It was oppressing black people here, brown people, you know, just ripped up the whole people that lived on this land here before were just systematically decimated, man. And those that were left, their culture was just viciously just, you know, brutalized and torn apart and stomped on and shit. I mean, these motherfuckers, man, in 1870, or in the 18, you know, 50 to 70 around in there, killed off all the buffalo, man, in North America, man, systematically went out and decimated, you know, the whole basis of a civilization of people, you know. I mean, you just don't want anything, you know. They talk about George Washington, man. I don't know nothing about George Washington. I didn't, you know, I ain't in Vietnam, you know. I ain't got nothing to do with that shit, you see. I mean, you began increasingly to see that there were more and more people who, if they couldn't articulate their feelings this way, felt this way, you know, and who expressed this feeling
by walking down the street with hair down to their ass and funny looking clothes on, you know, and smoking joints and taking their clothes off and shit like that, you know, who were saying, we ain't going to no factory, you know, if we're going to go to these schools, they ain't going to stay like this, you know, who were saying, we aren't going to go along with any of this shit any more than we have to, you know, if we have to go into war, then we're going to try and fuck it up, you know. I mean, people who, you know, who you couldn't go up to on the street and say, well, what do you think of Western civilization? Well, I think Western civilization, you know, they can't run no thing like that, you know. But if you looked at them, you could tell what they thought of Western civilization. You know, it sucks shit like a dog, you know, essentially. You see what I mean? So we began, you know, increasingly to look at this, and we had tried to explain in terms of white youth before, you know. White youth, you see, we thought, well, we aren't, you know, I mean, what do you mean by white? You know, do you mean white as a color? You know, or white actually as a culture, you see? So you start thinking about it. You think about, what do they mean by black people? They mean people who are black, you know, because there's people who, you know, relate to the world as black people who are whiter than I am. You know, at one time I related to the world as a black person, you know? At one point in my history, I was so alienated from where I had come from, I didn't want to never have anything to do with white people again. I wanted to be black, you know, that was essentially my thing, you know? So, started thinking about what does it mean to be a color, you know? And you get down to the fact that it isn't about color at all, you know? It's about being part of a people with a national culture, you know? I mean, if you look at it objectively, it's hard to call Clifford Wharton, for example, a black person. Clifford Wharton is a honky, you know? You see? I mean, his skin is, you know, but essentially he's a honky, you know. So you get into that, you get into things like Arabs and Jews come from the same racial stock, you know. But they aren't a people. They're two different people, you see, with very serious antagonisms, right? Very serious antagonisms indeed. And, so we just got down to the basis saying that it isn't about being white. The first thing we got to do is get rid of white, you know, because it ain't about, we ain't white, you know. And we're a people, but we aren't white people, we aren't even a Western people, you know, we're some kind of weird electronic aborigines, you know. I mean, we're just new, you know, there just hasn't been nothing like this before, see. And what is it, you know, and then you get down into the kind, what does this mean? You see, what does this phenomenon mean? You know, how did we come, is this an accident? You know, where did rock and roll come? I mean, why hasn't rock and roll ever existed before in history, you see? And you start thinking about, well, they never had amplifiers before, you know?
Electricity.
They never had electricity like this, you see? You know, they never had electric guitars, you know? So, I mean, it must be a particular historical development, you know, there must be a material basis for this, because things just don't happen by accident, you know. So we started getting down into it, and of course a lot of this, you know, I mean, these discussions were just incredible, you know. You got four people who are in the, three of them are in the Wayne County Jail, and one of them's in the Wayne County, two of them are in the Wayne County Jail, one of them's in Sandstone, Minnesota in the federal penitentiary. One of them being shifted from Marquette to Jackson to the Wayne County Jail to this and that. Other people out in the street trying to struggle for survival, day to day struggle to pay the rent and get the groceries and carry on some kind of little propaganda work or whatever you're doing to try and raise people's level. And in the midst of all this, you know, this incredible political discussion is taking place, you know, through letters and half-hour visits and hollering to, you know, well, what do you think about rainbow people, you know? Well, you see what I mean? It was really dynamite, yeah.
Metaphorically speaking.
Yeah. So we would get down, and the people who were in the prison were actually the research people, you know. We would be reading Lenin, and we'd be down in Essential Works of Lenin, and reading State and Revolution, you know what I'm saying? Jesus Christ. You know, you know, and then taking Mao Tse-tung, you know, and reading the stuff in there and trying and Marx and Engels and reading everything we could to make us try and figure out what was going on in the world, you know, and began to understand certain methods of analysis that have been developed by Marxist-Leninists, you know, the method of dialectical materialism, stuff like that, which, you know, we won't even go into now, but we began to get deeper and deeper into this, you know, and checking it out, and began to see that in with the arrival or the emergence, actually, of electronic technology, cybernetic technology, the atomic bomb, you know, and all these things around the time of 1940 to 1945, that a tremendous, you know, and this isn't anything new to us. I mean, a lot of people are saying this, you know, so I don't want to say that we advance the ideology of post-industrial life and all that bullshit, you know. But we just began to put it together, you know, and to see that a change had taken place in the material basis of society, which was like at least as big as the change that took place when the Industrial Revolution jumped off, you know, when they switched from farming and trading to industrial production. You know, it changed the whole shape and led to the birth of socialism and et cetera, you know. Well, we're sort of seeing that this change that's taking place now is at least as big as that. You see what I mean? That in the future, production isn't going to be organized by people working with machines and stamping, you know, the assembly line thing, you know. That now they have machines to do that kind of production, you know. That you don't need clerks and people sitting and writing stuff down. I mean, the computers, you know, can do that. That information can be spread all over the globe. That all these conditions are changing, you know, that what Marx talked about, people being free to develop their humanity, free from having to work, to do manual labor, you know, that these conditions were now beginning to come into effect, you see. And we began to see that this situation, like that we had entered into a transitory period from industrial society, industrial productive relations, industrial culture, you know, which is the nuclear family, right? The nuclear family is the basic production unit in society. The man is the worker, and the woman is the man's worker, and the children's as their replacements, you know. The whole nuclear family rules, the whole school rules, you know, all of that stuff, that all that was over with, you know. And because it no longer fit the needs of the particular historical era, right? We began to see that what was emerging, that this technology would make possible a leap for humanity from one stage of development to a higher stage, you know, such as taking place at different times in the past. So, and that the content of this new situation would be that machines, technology of some sort, did the work, most of the bulk of the work, that what other work was done would be service work, you know, that people, in other words, would generally be freed, you know, from all this, that another thing would be new ways of creating fuel and things like that, nuclear energy and solar plants and things like that, would replace coal and gas and oil and shit like that. So all of that pollution and all that exploitation of Africa, Asia, and Latin America for coal and oil and all that could be done away with, you know. And in other words, that this change was making possible all kinds of advances, right? That in terms of food production, you know, enough food could be produced through the, you know, through the higher technology to serve the needs of all the people on the planet, you know, for example. And all the stuff like that.
You want to get back to talking about the party?
Well, I'm still... Yeah. I mean, if I'm going to talk about the party, I got to talk about our analysis of, you know, otherwise it doesn't, you know, I could tell you we're so many people in such and such a house, but that doesn't speak to your question, you know.
What do you think of Elijah Muhammad?
What do I think of him?
Yeah, I mean, you know,
I don't think of him very much.
Right.
I think of the Muhammad speech and which is an excellent newspaper, which everybody who's interested in what's going on in the world should check into, Muhammad Speaks. I related very strongly to the black Muslim movement 10 years ago when Malcolm X was still Minister Malcolm, you know, and heard Malcolm X speak a number of times and followed all that very closely, you know, and thought it was very progressive, and thought when Malcolm X was expelled that that ended the progressive period of the Nation of Islam in this country, you know. It still has many progressive facets, particularly its stress on self-determination and self-reliance, but that any movement which is based on racism is not a healthy movement, you know. And that since their whole thing is based on racism on the one hand and another religious ruse on the other hand, that it wasn't a that it isn't a progressive movement in some, you know. That's essentially what I think of it. Well, you know, when we're talking about people, we're talking about all the people on the planet, you know, because that's essentially the people that exist, you know, unless you're talking about exterminating large numbers of people to narrow it down, you know. If you aren't talking about that, then you're talking about dealing with all the people who exist on the planet, you know.
So what are your plans for the next time?
Yeah. One. Did I leave off and...
No, I just want to make like one more point on the critical now is that you're disassociating yourself from the white culture and Western culture. That's the significance of it, right? More or less is that you're working for, let's say, the good of the whole planet, black, brown, yellow, green, whatever, right?
Right. Genie can run some of this.
The term rainbow comes from a whole bunch of legends, Indian legends. There's a book out called Warriors of the Rainbow. I don't know how many people have seen it. But it has to do with the legend itself runs down how the white man comes and essentially fucks everything up totally, and all the people are thrown into despair and separation. And then eventually all peoples of color rise up together and are able to work like the colors of the rainbow, which are able to remain distinct, you know, and yet can work in harmony, you know, with each other. When we were during that whole 9 months period, you know, struggle, when we were looking for a new name from the name White Panther, we had to consider things like people had seen the name White Panther and said, well, a lot of people reacted immediately saying, well, they're racist, right, going against the Black Panthers and are offering, you know, and
you know,
are being,
the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah, right, you know, or just some kind of white, you know, totally opposite to the Black Panthers. And then again, as John was saying, we watched our culture, you know, and in looking for the name, we tried to come up with a name that would come from our people, you know. And for a long time, the name that was put forth, you know, was from Woodstock, because we saw Woodstock as being one of the major events in our history, you know, as a people, you know, a major thing that happened. And for a long time, people thought that that was going to be the name, you know, that we were going to choose would be the Woodstock People's Party. But then, you know, like we kept watching our culture more and more, and people brought up the criticism that Woodstock itself was racist, you know, and that Woodstock itself was sexist, you know, and that Woodstock itself, even though it was a really, you know, important point in our history, and it will never be forgotten, you know, by the people who attended it, or, you know, since then, that it was not, you know, a forward enough looking name, or a name that would, you know, give us enough analysis and give people enough of a vision of the future, which is what we were looking for, you know, some kind of name that would make people feel good and would have some kind of analysis in it, you know, so that when we talked about it, it would have an analysis in it. And
so the questions like this would be raised, you know, what do you mean by rainbow people, you see?
So we chose the name rainbow people because it's a symbol, the rainbow is a symbol of unity all over the planet. And what we are seeking is self-determination, you know, for all peoples on the planet, you know, all peoples. And what we want is for people to be able to develop cultures, you know, naturally, for cultures to be able to develop and yet be able to develop in harmony with each other, you know, self-determination for all peoples on the planet is essentially what we're saying. So that's why we chose the name, you know, Rainbow People, because we saw that our culture, it really is growing up all over the planet. I mean, we met people, you know, freaks from Brazil that you would see them walking down the street and you would never be able to tell that they were from Brazil, you know, from Denmark. When I was in, you know, like I've traveled extensively. I even traveled to North Vietnam and found out that there were people in North Vietnam that are getting into our music, you know, and into our culture. And everywhere you go, you find our culture's growing up everywhere. And it's not like, you know, we're not white people. We're rainbow people. Our culture, our music comes from black music, right? Our sacraments, marijuana, comes from brown people. the philosophies we study, yin yang philosophy and the I Ching and macrobiotics, come from yellow people.
Mao Zedong.
You know, in Mao Zedong, we study Chairman Mao, you know, yellow people. There's, you know, our culture comes from all different kinds of cultures. Red people, Indians, we study the Indians here. Our clothing comes, you know, from Indians. Just, you know, we're a whole total conglomeration, and we're growing up all over the planet, and it's, you know, the name rainbow seems to be the most obvious name.
The killer flash of all time.
You know?